Hello, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's Line One program is from our archive at Alaska Public Media. It was recorded January 29th, 2016, and has been edited for today's broadcast. We won't be accepting phone calls or emails this afternoon, but we will give you an hour of valuable information about living with diabetes. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, it's more than likely that a little bit more knowledge and perhaps even a little bit more motivation will help you control these diseases even better. Local and national experts are going to be in Anchorage to present the latest and very best information on diabetes at the Taking Control of Your Diabetes Conference and Health Fair this February 20th at the Egan Convention Center. This is the first time that this national conference has been to Alaska, and today's Line One program, we will discuss the conference and diabetes with our guest, Dr. Stephen Edelman. Dr. Edelman is professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and he's a diabetes expert and actually is director of the VA Diabetic Clinic in San Diego. He is also the founder of the nonprofit organization Taking Control of Your Diabetes, which has provided educational and motivational programs such as the one coming to Anchorage for patients and providers for 21 years. Dr. Edelman, welcome to Line One, and thanks for all you're doing for diabetes education.
Well, thanks, Thad, and please call me Steve. We'll be informal on today's call.
I appreciate it.
I'm excited to be here.
All right, Steve. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and your medical interests.
Yeah, I'm going to do this real briefly. I'm going to start from the beginning. I was born and developed type 1 diabetes at age 15 in L.A., and I decided that I wanted to become a diabetes specialist, so I became an endocrinologist. I trained at the Joslin Clinic, and I started when I started faculty at UCSD in San Diego, University of California, San Diego, and I realized that although we had a lot of important information to be sent to the doctors to help them take better care of their patients, it's very slow going. It takes a lot of time, as you know, Thad, to transfer new information to the doctors, and they eventually change their practice habits, and then they eventually change the way they treat their patients with diabetes. So it was going too slow, so I said, hey, I want to take the most important messages about living with diabetes directly to the people and their family members who are most affected, people with diabetes. So that's when I started in 1995 this not-for-profit organization called Taking Control of Your Diabetes. So I've had a kind of a three-hat profession. You know, I'm a endocrinologist at a university, and I work at the VA hospital as well, do a lot of work with Native American Indians, and then I have diabetes myself, and then I started the not-for-profit that promotes education to people living with diabetes. And I'm a big believer that you can't just educate the doctors, you can't just educate the people living with diabetes. It needs to be both in a parallel approach. They can improve their communication with each other. So that's basically me in a nutshell.
What's the problems with educating the public and physicians? You mentioned there's a time delay getting new information. Are there other significant issues that jump out at you when you try to bring everybody up to speed?
Yeah, there is. You know, that's an excellent question, and a question that most people do not ask. I would say nowadays, on the professional side, it's what we call clinical inertia. When a caregiver graduates his or her medical program, like residency, they're so busy and so swamped because of our broken healthcare system and the lack of time, it's hard for them to keep up. And then on the other side, for patients, not enough people with diabetes or any chronic condition, asthma, I know that's one of your areas, they don't get educated enough. They don't educate themselves. They don't empower themselves, and not to take over their own disease completely. It's just to get knowledgeable, to work better with their caregiver, to get the best care possible. And then there's also motivational issues. You know, if you get diagnosed with diabetes, all of a sudden you got to change your eating habits, you got to change your exercise habits, you got to become more regular, you got to take pills, you might need to take shots, you have to go see the eye doctor, foot doctor, you know. And so We ask a lot of people with diabetes to follow what they're supposed to do. And then the minute they can't do it, they get labeled as non-compliant. And then that sets up a negative doctor-patient relationship, and then it all goes downhill from there. So unfortunately, it's lack of education, lack of time, and lack of really good education that motivates not only people with diabetes, but also motivates caregivers to keep up on the latest advances in diabetes.
As you said, we talked before the program, and I was involved quite a bit up here with asthma education. And the reason for that is I had come to the conclusion that the more the patients know and understand about asthma and the medications, the more likely they were to follow through and have the motivation to take care of their problems. It's still difficult, but would you, I'm guessing you have the same philosophy that if people understand some of the nuances about medications, the disease, how it happens, why it happens, what you can do about it, the likelihood of following through with the best advice we can give increases.
Oh, you know what? When you said that a second ago, I'm thinking, gee, that's exactly my philosophy. You know, knowledge is power. And, you know, I should take one split second to read you our mission statement. Guided by the belief that every person with diabetes has the right to live a healthy, happy, and productive life, taking control of your diabetes educates and motivates people with diabetes to take a more active role in their condition. So that's basically it. Knowledge is power, and I think, you know, once a person with diabetes, like myself, gets educated, it does take away a lot of the fear, anxiety, misconceptions that we all have regarding a chronic condition. Because, you know, if you don't know much, all you hear about, yeah, you're going to die of some horrible complication, you're going to become blind, you're going to lose your leg, you know, and they're going to hear things like diabetics should never eat sugar and a bunch of other weird wives' tales. So it's all about knowledge, and it sometimes can be frustrating if you go to a doctor who's not that knowledgeable. You know, most doctors are, you know, they went into the field to help people, but they just may not be up to snuff. So it's your job as someone living with a disease to help them become educated.
All right. So you founded Taking Control of Your Diabetes. You've developed a series of conferences. You've been doing these for 21 years. Tell us more about your organization and the expectations that individuals who are going to go to your conference in healthcare here in Anchorage can expect. What can they expect?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for having the show, because it is one of our challenges at Taking Control of Diabetes is getting people to commit a whole day to their health. And it's a commitment. But the basic concept behind the Taking Control of Your Diabetes programs that we started in 1995, and now we've expanded to 10 or 12 cities a year, is to give folks the education they need to stay healthy, but do it in a way that's interesting, that's humorous, that's engaging. And, you know, there are a lot of diabetes classes that are quite boring. And, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. And so we try to get speakers who have diabetes themselves, just like me, both type 1 and type 2. And we also scoured the Anchorage area for caregivers interested in being on the faculty. And I must tell your listeners that I was extremely impressed by the level of education and knowledge base and attitude of many of the physicians that specialize in the different areas of diabetes, from diabetes specialists all the way down to podiatrists and folks that specialize in gastrointestinal disorders and things like that, because we know that it can affect different organs in the body. So the whole purpose of the conference, and I want to just emphasize too, Thad, that it's also very much for the significant other, the folks that are partners, you know, the wife, the husband, the sons, the daughters, because I've been a big believer that if you don't educate the significant other, you're missing a big piece of the education puzzle. And I think that's probably true with asthma as well. I mean, you know, that you've got to educate the whole family. And so that's the overall goal of the meeting. And I think, you know, I can just tell you after doing this for 22 years, that I think I can't even think of one person who didn't walk away feeling pretty motivated, empowered, feeling empowered with knowledge, and whether they're getting them off their rear to start doing something they should have been doing, or to learn, or to ask their caregiver about a new insulin pump or a continuous glucose monitor or a new oral medication. And I think it's an eye opener for family members as well. Now, the other part of the conference, as I mentioned earlier, about how you have to educate caregivers and patients in a parallel manner, we have a concurrent program for those of you that are not familiar with the word CME, continuing medical education, where we're going to have, we've already got signed up close to 200 diabetes professionals from all walks of life in Anchorage to do their own program in the convention center at the same time. They'll be in their own room learning, giving doctor lectures on the latest cutting-edge therapies, but you're going to see them for part of the day. So we actually intermingle these professionals with the folks with diabetes in different time periods throughout the day. It's the only program that I know of and I've ever heard of that puts providers and patients together in the same educational setting. So that's sort of the overall theme and goals of the conference.
So you're right. It's a little unusual. In fact, I guess I'd have to say it's unique in my experience where physicians, providers, and patients are together, sometimes in the same room, which makes a lot of sense to me because we're getting into this increasing part of medicine or area of medicine where it's so individualized. We have to understand the individual understanding of patients, the individual burdens they bring, the problems they have, that if we're really going to make contact, and I don't know how else you can do that, but by talking together.
It's, you know what, it's communication that I just want to read you the title of the workshop where we specifically put the folks together. It's called Bad Doctor, Good Patient, Good Doctor, Bad Patient. And it's moderated by myself and a clinical psychologist, Bill Polonsky, who's actually an international expert on the behavioral and emotional issues of diabetes, and he actually is going to be speaking to the participants with diabetes in the morning, and then he speaks to the healthcare providers there in a different time period. So it's a lot of fun, and we try to make it fun and interesting. And you know, I'm Mr. Jokester, so I'm always trying to infuse humor. And I think you and I remember medical school that we had some of the worst boring professors in the world, and the ones we remember the most is the funny ones. And so I'm a big believer that humor leads to information retention, whether you're a provider or you're someone with diabetes. So we try to, and we have a special formula that we use that's been very successful, taking advantage of the local diabetes folks in the community.
My guest today is Dr. Stephen Edelman. Dr. Edelman is the founder of a nonprofit organization called Taking Control of Your Diabetes. So let's just start. What's changed? What's happened about type 1 and type 2 diabetes over the last 25 years or so? What are the big highlights? What's the epidemiology, so to speak? Where are we going?
Well, gosh, that's a tremendous question, and I'm going to try to be brief so we have time for callers. And I think that going back 25 years, you know, things really didn't change until about 10 to 15 years ago, to be honest. I mean, things were pretty stagnant. And the other thing I want to mention is that you really have to separate out type 1 versus type 2. You know, type 1 is the type that I had, formerly called juvenile onset. And it kind of was a death sentence in 1970 when I got it because people just developed, you know, kidney disease. They lost their limbs. They became blind, and we didn't have too many tools. But I'll just tell you what: at the conference on February 20th, we have a type 1 track, and some of the main things we emphasize in that and highlighting the advancements. Well, one, I think the single biggest advance is continuous glucose monitoring. Put a little sensor under your skin yourself. It takes about 30 seconds. You carry a monitor, and by Bluetooth, you get your blood sugar every 5 minutes. You get a trend arrow that tells you if your blood sugar is going up or down, and you also have built-in alerts that warn you before you get too high, and you can give yourself a little correction dose of insulin, because every person with type 1 is on insulin. And very importantly, it warns you well before you get dangerously low, where you can become out of it and get in a car accident or break your hip or hurt yourself or hurt others. And so it just allows you to stay in the zone much more than we could before with just sporadic blood sugar testing, you know, with little meters that just tell your blood sugar at one point in time. Now, in addition to that, we got insulin pumps and all kinds of new insulin pumps. We also have software programs. In fact, the continuous glucose monitoring system, the numbers go right from your little transmitter where the sensor is to your phone up to the cloud to up to five people who want to follow you. So your spouse, I have my girlfriend, and I have a few other buddies follow me. So that if I start to get dangerously low, they're notified. They text me, they call me, and they say, "You okay?" I go, "Yeah, I'm getting some sugar." So I mean, for parents of young kids with diabetes, it's been unbelievable. So continuous glucose monitoring, insulin pumps, newer insulin pens, and newer insulins, including inhaled insulin. In addition to that, all kinds of new treatments for celiac, which is another autoimmune condition for people with diabetes. And we have, so I think those are kind of the biggest. And we're going to talk about the next step in type 1, which is creating a marriage between a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump using sophisticated software so that the person with diabetes doesn't have to think about giving themselves the right amount of insulin at the right time. It's done automatically based on the frequently sampled numbers from the continuous glucose monitor. Now, before I switch to type 2, I just want to say that every person with type 1 diabetes in Anchorage and in the United States should have a continuous glucose monitor. It's the standard of care. And getting back to some of the issues in our healthcare educational system, that only about 20% of type 1s are on a continuous glucose monitor. They don't know about it. Their doctor doesn't know about it. Sometimes insurance companies, you know, they put up roadblocks.
Right.
So before I switch to type 2, do you got any questions in there first? I don't want to talk all day.
Yeah, no, I think that the important lesson also that I would like to echo what you've kind of said is that type 1 diabetes 25 years ago was not a good diagnosis for lifespan, and now it's my understanding that most people with type 1 diabetes managed effectively have a much, much, much better lifespan, maybe normal lifespan. You'll have to correct me on that. But it can be achieved with these type 1 diabetics.
Totally. Okay. Totally. I'm not just saying that to make myself feel better. Statistics back me up.
Right.
I would say this. You're not going to believe this, Thad, and your listeners may not believe this, but I'm a big believer, and this came up today when I saw a patient earlier, that just by the fact that you get diabetes and you get proper education, you get motivated, all of a sudden you're exercising regularly more because that's what's part of the prescription. You get into it so you enjoy it. You don't have to feel like it's some type of punishment. You start eating better. You pay a little more attention to those other conditions associated with diabetes, like high blood pressure, abnormal cholesterol. And the bottom line is you might live longer because you got diabetes.
Okay. All right.
And that, you know, that sounds goofy. Now, in type 2, back 25 years ago, type 2 diabetes wasn't taken seriously. Everyone said it was just a touch of sugar. You know, it was called adult onset. And the reason why they got away from the word adult onset and juvenile onset, because you can get type 1 and type 2 diabetes at any age. I just saw a patient, I can believe this, 94 years old, who got type 1 that we used to call juvenile onset. And in San Diego, where we have a lot of Latino kids, I saw a 5-year-old who had type 2 diabetes. You know, he was heavy. Both his parents had type 2. And as you know, it's pretty hereditary. But just to get a brief one or two sentences on the advances in type 2, all I can say is unbelievable advances. Because 25 years ago, all they had was one type of oral medication. And you know these well, that, you know, the sulfonylureas like glipizide, glipiride. And now, believe it or not, we have 9 different classes, meaning that there might be 3 or 4 in one class from different competing companies. So we have tremendous choices. We have all kinds of newer insulins, and we have a whole new class of medications called, I hate to say this because it's so medically oriented, GLP-1 receptor agonists. They're incretins, drugs like Victoza, Bydureon, Tandiam, Trulicity. There's four companies, and these drugs are meant for type 2, and they're just tremendous benefit to our whole diabetes toolbox. So the bottom line is that, without getting into too much of the details, our toolbox for type 2 has expanded in an incredible manner. And the thing is, many caregivers don't know about these drugs. Mm-hmm. People with diabetes don't know about them. So if you come to our conference or learn about them in any conference online, you know, a knowledgeable person with diabetes is going to say, hey, I think this medication may help me from what I've learned about it. I'm going to ask my caregiver. And that's exactly what we want to come out of this conference is we don't want you to take over your own care. We don't want you to do things, you know, without asking your caregiver. We want you to say, okay, I'm a type 1. I don't have a continuous glucose monitor. My blood sugars are bouncing around all over the place. I think this thing could really help me. So I'm going to go ask my caregiver to see if we can get one. That's music to my ears.
Couple of questions, again, come out of that. But before I address those, I have a caller I want to take, Ann, see what she has to ask. Ann, you're on line one?
Yes, I am.
What can we do for you?
Well, my first comment is thank you for the topic. I'm already signed up for the conference. My doctor told me about it. But one of the questions that I have perpetually is about the amount of exercise that a type 2 person like myself should do and how frequently, because I'm not sure if it makes a difference if you exercise every day. I exercise 6 days a week for about an hour each time, or if I could maybe pull back and just figure that three or four times would be just as good as a cumulative amount. And I don't understand quite the chemistry of why exercise is so important, except for weight loss and just feeling good.
Okay.
Well, it's a great question, and make sure you come on up and say hi at the conference. Well, first of all, exercise, you can talk all day on the benefits of exercise. But what we try to do at TCOID is to try to tell people that there's you got to do what you enjoy. You can't just take someone who's 60 years old and say, go join a healthcare gym, get some spandex, and, you know, of course, that's going to last like 3 weeks, you know. But I think the whole concept of exercise is so important, not only the physiological, but also the psychological, and it helps the medications work better. So the answer to your question is, if you want a real official answer, the beneficial of exercise actually, if you do a cardiovascular for an hour, and like you said, you know, you're pretty darn good. You're way more than the national average. Last 48 hours. So if you told me I'm going to exercise every other day, maybe Saturday and Sunday, and two times during the week, that would be excellent. So it's really, and where did they get this information from? Oh, you know, just all kinds of exercise physiology type of research. So every other day, cardiovascular is awesome. Now, if you told me you enjoy it, you love it, you watch your favorite Netflix series on your treadmill at home or your exercise, and you do it 6 days a week, more power to you. So the answer is it's partially official every other day, and it's partially individual. Whatever you like to do, and if you like to do it every day, you know, as long as you're not overusing your body and hurting your ankles and knees, more power to you. I congratulate you. I think there's very few people. I bet you Thad doesn't even exercise 6 days a week.
Well, of course, we're
no comment.
Oh, this year, but one thing that I don't know if listeners know is that if you have insurance, your doctor can write you a prescription to help pay for the cost of the gym. And same with the FSA Feds kind of program where you put some money aside for medical things. That because so many of us up here have to pay for a gym to go indoors in the winter. Thanks to my doctor and providers, I was able to get a little help with that cost.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. I think you just reminded me to say something about our registration fee. The actual cost for this conference is $175 a person to the not-for-profit. And I think if for any of you listeners, we're only asking for $15 a person, $10 a person for two or more registering at the same time. And day of registration is $20. But let me just also say that if you're listening or you know someone that wants to attend but cannot afford that, then please, we give scholarships and we allow people in complimentary. But we're careful on that because, you know, a lot of people that sign up, if you don't pay anything, that you don't show up. So the conferences are subsidized, meaning that we're a not-for-profit organization. We look for grants, foundation grants. We have a private donors in the States because we've never been to Anchorage. So we try to keep the registration extremely low so to not limit anybody from attending. We do give scholarships if you can't afford that.
All right. Thanks very much. Ann, thanks for your call. We're going to take our usual halfway break right now, Dr. Edelman, and we'll be back with you shortly.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on Diabetes, recorded January 29th, 2016. Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Joining us today by telephone is Dr. Stephen Edelman, who's professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego, a diabetes specialist who also runs the diabetes clinic for the VA system in San Diego. More importantly, perhaps for our discussion today, he's the founder of a nonprofit organization entitled Taking Control of Your Diabetes, which has provided educational and motivational programs for patients with diabetes and their providers for over 21 years. The first time this conference is going to be in Alaska will be February 20th at the Egan Convention Center. You can sign up by going to Taking Control of Your Diabetes on your internet browser. You should get to their website, and there is a little label that says events, and from there you'll have the Anchorage event that's coming up February 20th. You also can find that link at alaskapublic.org at the Line 1 program link. I want to remind listeners, if you're listening to the program between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evenings, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer any questions for you at that particular time. So, Dr. Edelman, listening to your description, particularly of type 2 diabetes, makes me realize that the complexity of this management of this problem has gotten increasingly difficult with all the medications. But it also, what I've been able to follow up on better, because I don't do a lot of type 2 diabetes coverage, is I love to keep track of what's happening with diabetes. And my understanding of type 2 diabetes is it's a bunch of different diseases probably that all lead through a pathway that seems to be that insulin there's a resistance to the insulin effect on cells, which gets glucose and energy into the body. And I'd like you to comment on both maybe the need for education because of the complexity of management and also the complexity we're finding about what really type 2 diabetes is all about.
Yeah, not bad for a pediatrician. That was good. Well, let me just say that folks with type 1, it's an autoimmune condition. For some reason, for example, when I was 15, my own body started to produce antibodies that attack my own pancreas, usually we have these antibodies that attack foreign substances, like you get a cut and your finger gets infected, there's a piece of splinter in there and it somehow attacks that. But for some reason my immune system went awry, and that's why Since it attacked my and destroyed my pancreas, my insulin-producing cells, I've been on insulin ever since I was 15 years old. Now, type 2 is quite different, and you mentioned it in your diagnostic monologue there. That was perfect, that the insulin, that people with type 2 do secrete insulin. It just doesn't work well. It doesn't, the cells of our body, the muscle, the fat, liver, it's resistant to the glucose-lowering effects of insulin because insulin allows the nutrients in the blood to get into the different cells of our body for energy. So when you, we don't really know what causes type 2 diabetes. We know a lot about type 1. It's autoimmune. And so as we're learning more and more about the different abnormalities that lead to high blood sugars in type 2, it turns out that we come up with a pharmaceutical a medication to address those defects. And that's why the more we've learned about type 2, and as I mentioned earlier, we have 9 different classes of oral agents. So Thad, it's a lot more than insulin resistance these days. There's issues with the kidneys holding on to glucose versus pushing it out in the urine. There's medications that replace another hormone that's absent, which is called GLP-1. I talked about those drugs a little bit earlier. And so treating type 2 used to be super simple. You tried this one type of pill in, 1990. If it didn't work, you went to one type of insulin. And as a result, things weren't very good. And as I said earlier, type 2 was not taken seriously. It was just like a touch of sugar. But I can tell you that type 2 has become more serious than we previously thought because it's associated with those cardiovascular risk factors, high blood pressure, abnormal cholesterol, abnormalities in how easily the blood clots, which is not good. And it turns out that type 2 is pretty serious if you don't treat it. But for both type 1 and type 2, I think the big positive message is diabetes is a treatable condition. And that's the main reason we put on these conferences. So just to summarize, type 2 has become extremely complicated, and that's why most doctors have a hard time keeping up with the advances. You don't know which drugs to use first. You don't know which drugs to use together. You don't know the pros and cons. If you don't know that, you're not going to offer the folks in your practice with it because you just don't know, and you stick to the same old, which may not be working.
All right. I want to go ahead and take another caller. Bruce from Palmer, you're on line one.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My son was diagnosed at 14, he's now 20, and he manages it pretty well, but he does the self-injections, and I'm trying to convince him to do the pump. I can't. any words of wisdom to try to get him down that road?
Okay, so he's type 1 diabetic.
Does he have
type
a continuous
one,
glucose monitor?
He doesn't. And this is the first I've heard of it, so this will be something else I can talk to him about.
See, that's shocking to me, because I'll tell you, Bruce, a continuous glucose monitor, and the one I use is made by Dexcom, and DEXCOM, that's the best one.
Okay.
And there's no, there's no kickback from the company. That's just the nature of the beast. It's the one I wear. That is way more important than a pump, if you can believe that.
Oh, okay.
So if you told me, if someone said to me, Steve, in order to keep your Dexcom, you have to give back your pump. You got to go back on the older insulins. I would do it because knowing where your blood sugar is every 5 minutes and what direction it's going is invaluable. Now, so that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, we don't listen to our parents. So
right.
I think at the conference, Bruce, there's a type 1 track. It's perfect for someone 20 years old. And the best way to convince someone, let's just say a pump could really help him, is to be around others who have experienced the success of being on a pump. And so without shoving it down his throat, which obviously I know you're not doing that, but you're a concerned parent, obviously, you stop pushing, but you get them in a group of other people who have. And so we actually have, as part of the conference, he'll be around other people on an insulin pump, and they'll have sessions on it, and he'll listen to other people, and he needs to obviously in his own mind say, hey, I wonder if this will help me. So for example, there's a session at 1:30 called Pumping Techniques. Now, even though this session is for people that may be on a pump, it might be really good for him to sit in and just listen. And there's only one other workshop going on at that time on celiac. And the other session on continuous glucose monitoring starts at 11:30. So
yeah,
you can see that.
That's what I'm interested in for him. You know, he's 20 and he's very active, and I just think he thinks the pump's going to get in the way. But if this continuous glucose monitoring might be a ticket for him, then where he doesn't have to use the pump.
Trust me, what it'll do for him if he's active, he'll prevent him from having all those gosh darn lows that drive him nuts. Be able to avert a lot of the highs, but also the lows. And it's very obsequious. It goes under your skin. It's waterproof. You carry a little monitor. And, in fact, you can have the information go right to a smartphone. And I think, you know, for me...
Oh, he would like that.
It'll just open it up. It'll open it up for him. And you can follow him if he lets you.
Oh, he will. Well, I appreciate it very much. That's very good information. Thanks a lot.
All right. Okay, you're welcome.
All right, let's take one more caller while we're on this this roll. This is Mike from Palmer. What can we do for you?
Hello.
Mike, yeah, what can we do for you?
Oh, well, my son also has diabetes and has since he was 4 years old, and he's on a pump, and he's actually doing very well, and he has the glucose monitor and all. And, boy, that's the difference between night and day as far as the way he went from going up and down and all. And now it's just amazing how much better he feels. It's completely a different thing. So, but the question that I have is I noticed here a while back where they had a thing that I think it was Harvard University that said type 1 diabetes cure imminent. And my aunt has also said things. She's in Canada, and they said they have done like a regeneration of good pancreas cells and injected them into a bad pancreas, and it regenerated the cells or the pancreas, mm-hmm. and made it, and they had a very high success rate of that. So I'm just wondering what your information is on that and what you know about it.
Great question.
Yeah, I am familiar with that. This guy named Doug Melton. Well, I can tell you one thing that kind of makes me angry a little bit is these headlines, because people like yourself, this is going to be next week. They're very far from coming up with an ultimate cure. Now, are they doing good research? Absolutely. And, you know, I'm involved in a study in San Diego where they're putting stem cells in a little protective device that you put under the skin. And the reason why you need to put these in the protective device is because it protects it from those antibodies that cause diabetes in the first place. And this guy in Boston is able to synthesize in a laboratory, cells that can become pancreatic beta cells, so you don't have to worry about, you know, the abortion issue. So, yeah, there's lots of exciting things going on. And this stuff is further down the line, 10, 15, 20 years. Now, what I mentioned earlier on the show, which is really much closer to home, and for you and your kid and Bruce's kid, is the artificial pancreas. It's taking current technology, insulin pumps, and continuous glucose monitoring, and using sophisticated algorithms to completely control the blood sugar, stay in a really tight range without any influence from the patient, no decisions. So that is right around the corner because it's based on current technology. It's not a cure, but it's pretty darn good. And then think guys like these researchers in Boston, you know, they're working on some exciting areas, but the problem is and it may not be them making those headlines, but I do say that the headlines are a little too sensational for me, especially when I know how long it takes to develop these advances, because most of their studies are laboratory animals, not even humans.
Well, am I still on?
Yes, you are.
Well, my aunt is lived in Canada for many years, and she's a veterinarian. Anyway, she was telling me that they have had very successful. They've tried that in I think it was in Calgary area or one of that province or whatever, at a certain university, and they had a very high success rate.
You're talking about Edmonton, probably. You know what?
Yeah.
It's that comment is a little too sensational. Also, they've had some success.
Yeah.
But is it ready to go to the masses? Not even close. And trust
me,
there's no one that wants this better than yours truly.
We all do.
I just think that this research is important. It's good to point out, but we have to just really put it in context in a proper time frame, so people don't have unrealistic expectations.
Sure. Well, thank you. That's it's just good knowledge. I'm studying it all the time for my son, absolutely. And we all want a cure for it because it's something. But boy, has it sure gotten a lot better.
I've
got a history of that in my family, and it's amazing how the difference is now compared to what it was, 20 or 50 years ago. But it's like completely different,
And that's the whole purpose of the conference, is to bring people living with this condition and their loved ones up to snuff.
Yep.
Mike, thanks for your call.
Yep.
All right, let me remind everybody one more time. We're in our last 15 minutes or so. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Edelman. He is the founder of a nonprofit organization called Taking Control of Your Diabetes. He provides educational and motivational programs for patients and providers with diabetes and treating diabetes. Steve, I'm a little bit impressed all the time about the listeners of this program now, and the questions we get. But I'm also aware that there have to be people out there listening who just still don't get the basic idea of why control of their glucose is important. Could you expand on that question a little bit better for them?
Yeah, good question, Thad. Here's the thing, us caregivers are always concerned about trying to get your blood sugar as close to normal as possible. And we use blood sugar readings from meters and continuous glucose monitors, and we use the blood test called the hemoglobin A1C that gives us the average. And the reason is because high blood sugars over the years, not days, not weeks, not even months, leads to damage to certain organs in the body that are susceptible to what we call glucose toxicity, and that's basically the retina of the eyes, so that leads to blindness, the same sort of important membranes in the filtering system of the kidney, leading to kidney problems and, dialysis, transplantation, and to the nerves of our body, leading to lack of sensation in the extremities, numbness, and then susceptible to amputations. I'm not into scare tactics, but in answer to your question, in a very simple and but really kind of a good summary, is that blood sugars that are high over the years leads to damage to certain organs in our body, some more than others. Now, the other thing I have to mention, I've touched on it earlier, is that when you have diabetes, especially type 2, you are at risk for getting cardiovascular problems like heart attacks and strokes, because this whole condition that leads to insulin resistance, the medical phrase you and I both mentioned, that leads to high blood sugars, it also leads to abnormal cholesterol, high blood pressure, and abnormal blood clotting. And those are three risk factors for heart problems. So people with type 2 specifically have a higher risk of heart disease. Now, saying all that negative, scary stuff, every one of those conditions is totally treatable. Your diabetes is treatable, the blood pressure, cholesterol, getting on an aspirin helps with the clotting issue. So that's why it's so important for people with diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, to know what they need to do to stay healthy, find the best tools to do it, work with their caregiver to get the best tools possible, fight their insurance companies if they need to, in a constructive manner, to get the things they need. And that's what we push at our conferences, and that's the name of the whole organization, Taking Control of your Diabetes.
Okay, thank you for that. Mark, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I was diagnosed back when I was in, probably my mid-20s, and then for many years I would actually just almost, just see black and white and get all sweaty and fainty and, want to pass out, and then I'd eat, and, and then very shortly it would go away, and one time I even had my blood sugar checked, when that happened by an old man that was a friend of mine. It was down like below 20. And I guess my question is a doctor diagnosed me with reactive hypoglycemic, and mm-hmm. I stopped eating white bread, I stopped eating noodles, and took sugar out of my coffee. And if I eat like 5 times a day, I seem to do okay. I guess my question is there something I should be doing different, or is this going to turn into full-blown diabetes or what?
Yeah, it's a good, very good question, and it actually, it's not an uncommon question. We talk about the two main types of diabetes, you know, type 1 and type 2, but there's many different variations of the same theme. There is a condition called reactive hypoglycemia. It typically occurs in women, but it can occur in men, and if the overall tests for diabetes are negative, like this hemoglobin A1C, and if the blood sugar average is in the desirable range, but people get low at certain times, what you're doing now makes perfect sense. Is you get the concentrated, or what we call fast-acting carbohydrates, simple carbohydrates, out of your diet as much as you can, and spread your calories out throughout the day. You know, sticking to complex carbs, protein, and fat. And typically, that does not stimulate a lot of insulin at any one time from your own pancreas. That eventually doesn't cause you to get too low. So, you know, diet, if spreading out your calories and taking the real fast acting carbs like cold cereal out of your diet, you know, for the most part, keeps your blood sugars in good control, hey, more power to you. But there are different types of diabetes that you may have a type that's really mild that eventually you may eventually get diabetes, because sometimes reactive hypoglycemia precedes the diabetes. Are you overweight by chance?
No, sir. Actually, I'm 53 years old. I weigh as much as I did in eighth grade. I'm 100 and, I don't know, probably about 50 pounds.
Congratulations. Probably all that cold. So I think, you know what, it's something that's been with you. It probably will stay with you. And if you can figure out a diet that you're happy to live with by spreading your calories and avoiding simple carbs, you know, that's a good lifestyle anyway. So, there is a condition like that, and you sounds like you fit right into it.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
We have about 7 minutes left, Steve, and one of the things that we have not discussed that I think we ought to is a little bit different tact here, and that's going into prevention. What do we know currently, since we know so much about the immunology, the immunologic system now, and the things that get diabetes type 1 going, can we talk about it in any useful way, prevention of type 1, and then follow that up with what we can tell people they can do that prevent type 2 diabetes?
Yeah. Well, it's another great question. First of all, for type 1, it is an autoimmune condition. We don't have any prevention strategies at all. We know it's so interesting that we know what causes type 1. We know a lot more what causes type 1 than we know what causes type 2, yet we have no prevention strategies. Now, let's go to type 2. We don't have a clue what causes type 2, but we do have prevention strategies. And I've personally been involved in at least 2 large prevention studies where we took people whose blood sugars were not normal, but they weren't high enough to be in the diabetic range, and it's a certain specific category that we call pre-diabetes, and we do an intervention to try to prevent them from progressing on to getting type 2. And so, you know, lifestyle modification is extremely effective. You know, at least exercising, you know, 30 minutes a day with C. Everett, you know, 5-6 days a week, losing not a lot of weight, but like 4 or 5% of the body weight, and exercise. We know that works if you can do it consistently. Then the other thing is, what we know a lot about preventing type 2 is we use drugs that are already approved for type 2 once you get it, but using them a little bit earlier in the natural history. So, for example, once you get type 2, as I told you earlier, our toolbox is huge, and we know that if you use a certain subset of those medications earlier in people who are at risk, who have blood sugars that are a little bit high but not in the diagnostic range yet, if you use it earlier, you can prevent it in those folks as long as they continue taking the medication. So who's at risk for type 2? definitely if it runs in your family. You know, it's always our parents' fault. You know that. And type 2 is a very strong hereditary condition, passed along from generation to generation. If you have central weight problems, like if you have kind of a large waist-to-hip ratio, and if you have high blood pressure, abnormal cholesterol, if you're a female that you had a baby that weighed over 10 pounds, these are all risk factors. And one of the other biggest risk factors is being a member of a certain ethnic group. So, of course, Native American Indians, Alaskan Indians have a very high rate. Latinos, African Americans, and Native American Indians, and Pacific Islanders. So there's a large so it could run in your genes, and we can prevent it, but it comes down to early detection because there are no symptoms in the pre-diabetic range. So it's really the first step is education. You know, for me, if someone says, yeah, both my parents had type 2, you should be telling your doctor that and getting screened at least every year. Maybe even get your own glucose meter and test your blood sugar at home once in a while after a large meal. And because it's just all about knowledge. And off that, I'll say one more sentence and I'll shut up, is that it always is amazes to me when someone is shocked when I tell them they have type 2 diabetes, but yet their mother had it, their brother had it, their two kids have it. It's like, are you really shocked? And so it just comes down to education once again.
So certainly a strong family history, regardless of how you look and how much you exercise and how much you think you're healthy, it's not a bad idea to get screened periodically.
It sounds definitely. Like. And you're right. And screening is so easy, too. Well, thanks very much. I know that you got to end, and thanks for letting your listeners know about the program. If you have any questions at all, just call our office, and the number's right on our website.
Steve, give us one more minute of what's the most important thing you want people to remember from the program today.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is diabetes is tough to live with. There's a lot of guilt, anxiety, labeling of non-compliance out there. And certainly I know it's tough, and that's why we design these programs. And I think knowledge is power, whether you're a type 1 or type 2, no matter what your individual problem is, become knowledgeable. Find out what medications and devices that could help you. Speak to diabetes specialists, like especially dietitians, and bring those ideas to your caregiver. There's no caregiver I know of that if you bring in a reasonable request, they'll downright say no. And if they do, go find another doctor. But I think knowledge is power. It's your condition, and I think you'll live a longer health for it.
Thanks very much, Steve. We appreciate it.
Okay, Fed.
All right. My thanks once again to Dr. Stephen Edelman for taking the time to host Taking Control of Your Diabetes Conference and Health Fair this February 20th at the Egan Convention Center. I urge people involved with diabetes to attend that. I think it'll be well worth your time and effort. Also, I want to remind everybody that the program will return next week, Line 1 will, and I won't be the host at that program. Our co-host, Prentice Pimpernan, will be here. And what we're going to do is take a look at historical physiologic trauma. It's kind of a follow-up to the public TV PBS program ongoing right now about the Civil War called Mercy Street, which is a six-week program once a week that's looking in depth into the realities of a lot of the medicine but personal experiences in the Civil War. It turns out that these wars have all and other similar situations lead to quite a bit of historical trauma. So they'll be looking at that next week on Line 1. Let me remind you also that Pat Yack is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork helped us audio engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to today's Line 1 program on diabetes. This was recorded January 29th, 2016. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.